supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm John Weber, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Pennsylvania lawmakers are once again looking to place new taxes on natural gas drillers. A gas severance tax the Senate approved this week is expected to bring in $100 million to help plug a $2.2 billion budget hole. The measure has an uncertain future in the Republican-controlled House. Still, it's the closest the state has gotten to enacting such a tax in nearly a decade. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has a look at how the debate has unfolded over the years.
Pennsylvania remains the only major gas-producing state in the country without a severance tax. This fact has been a major sticking point in Harrisburg for a really long time. And while a tax has been talked about for years, the state's natural gas production has skyrocketed. Last year alone, it topped 5 trillion cubic feet, almost as much as the entire country of Qatar. In 2009, the state house, which was then controlled by Democrats, passed a severance tax. It was defeated by Republicans in the Senate. Since then, not much has happened.
I think the answer starts and ends at the power of the gas industry.
That's Representative Greg Vitale, a Delaware County Democrat.
You just look at the enormous influence they have on the legislature. You look at the money they give. You look at the lobbying.
All told, the gas industry has spent nearly $60 million on lobbying in Pennsylvania since the drilling boom began. But industry supporters are quick to point out they do pay for the privilege of working here. 5 years ago, the legislature passed a special impact fee. So now, gas companies pay a fee for each well they drill, whereas a severance tax would be paid based on how much gas is produced when they sever the resource from the earth. Former Republican Governor Tom Corbett signed the impact fee into law. He often touted the fact that most of the money was sent right back to communities where drilling occurs, helping to cut local taxes, improve roads, and emergency responsiveness. And he was staunchly against the idea of a severance tax.
Who better to know where to spend the money than the county commissioners, the township supervisors, the mayors, not necessarily Harrisburg?
Since it was enacted, the impact fees have brought in more than $1 billion. But the revenue from the fees has trended downward, even as gas production has shot up, because it's driven by the price of gas and the number of new wells drilled. So, as Mark Ryan of the state's independent fiscal office points out, there isn't a link between the revenue and the gas production.
I'd say there's no relationship for the most part, because it's really the price that has driven the impact fee.
Gas supporters say this really does amount to a tax. Some have started calling it the impact tax. This industry-funded commercial tries to make the case lawmakers shouldn't keep coming to drillers every time they need more money.
There are a lot of myths flying around about shale drilling.
Fact: natural gas companies are heavily taxed.
I think it's a tax.
That's Gene Barr, head of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry.
Politically, it was probably a mistake to call it an impact fee at that time. Should we have called it a severance tax? Maybe we should. Maybe we wouldn't be in this position here.
In the spring of 2014, the gas industry coordinated a major rally at the Capitol with thousands of supporters holding signs with things like energy equals jobs and protesting new taxes. But not long after that, the Corbett administration was staring down a similarly massive budget hole. Surprisingly, Corbett's budget secretary, Charles Zogby, said the administration would be open to a severance tax.
Again, I think there's multiple options that we can look at. I'm not ruling out a severance tax. You didn't hear me rule out a severance tax.
In the end, it didn't happen that year. But what did happen was an election that brought a new governor to town. Democrat Tom Wolf made taxing the natural gas industry a central campaign pledge.
We can't keep doing what we're doing. This is a roadmap to the better future I think we need to move toward.
In his first budget address to the legislature back in 2015, Wolf made a big push for it.
This is not about politics. This is not about politics or ideology. It's simply common sense.
But Wolf faced strong opposition from the Republican-controlled legislature. In his first year in office, Wolf and the Republican legislative leaders wound up in a 9-month-long budget standoff. And part of that showdown was over a severance tax. Chief among the critics of such a tax was House Speaker Mike Terzai.
I think the governor's severance tax proposals are designed to stop the growth of natural gas, and it is going to stop energy independence, and it is going to stop the growth of jobs in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
But now that Senate Republicans have agreed to this latest version of the severance tax, the ball is back in Terzai's court and the rest of the House. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Allentown voters weren't surprised this week when the federal prosecutors finally indicted Mayor Ed Pawlowski in a pay-to-play scheme after a 4-year investigation. But the people of Allentown are wondering what will happen next and whether the popular mayor will step down. Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall has more.
It seems like everyone in Allentown agrees. Ed Pawlowski has done a lot for the city, especially the downtown that used to be a ghost town. Miguel Morales owns 904 West Restaurant and Lounge. After the mayor's push for redevelopment, his establishment is thriving.
We have come a long, long way. I will say 4 or 5 years ago, if you wanted to eat something good, you had to go to Philly. Now we can actually go here somewhere downtown. So I'm not saying that it was all him, but he was the mayor when it was happening.
My reaction was really a great deal of sadness.
Rose Craig, an executive with Communities and Schools, remembers introducing Pawlowski to Allentown movers and shakers when he first arrived in the Lehigh Valley from Chicago more than 20 years ago.
He was a guy who really had a lot on the ball. He was real smart. He really opened up communication with some of the minorities in town. He had a natural instinct for building community.
Pawlowski has denied any wrongdoing and vows to run for a fourth term. Many in local government, including Lehigh County Commissioner David Jones, have called for him to step down.
Politics has always been about the arena of public opinion, and it's a violation of trust. And I don't think he has the moral authority to lead the city any longer.
But Morales says Pawlowski has built up so much goodwill in Allentown that if he does run against Republican challenger Nat Hyman, he could possibly win in a city that is solidly Democratic.
He's very well liked, unless for the people that, of course, are Republicans.
Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
The United States has never had a president as polarizing as Donald Trump. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller enlisted the help of Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, to delve into why that is as the president enters his 8th month in office.
This isn't a huge surprise, but what do the numbers show?
Well, we're able to now look at the second quarter for Donald Trump, which ended, of course, 6 months after he took office, which was January the 20th. That allows us to combine interviews and then compare him to the second quarters of other presidents who were newly elected, going all the way back to Dwight Eisenhower. Trump's number, 39%, to be precise, 38.8%. And as I mentioned, we can compare that to all the other newly elected presidents since World War II, and that, as you mentioned, is dead last. The closest to Trump was Bill Clinton back in 1993. He had 44%, but beyond that, every other newly elected president was at the majority level or higher. And you go back to John Kennedy and you go back to Dwight Eisenhower, they both had job approval ratings in the second quarters of their terms in office above 70%.
How about Donald Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama?
Obama was doing quite well on a relative basis in his second quarter, which would have been in 2009, 62% job approval rating. He had a honeymoon period, which Trump didn't.
I was looking at the map Gallup generated where it focuses on states, and there's a broad swath right through the middle for Trump.
That's absolutely right. You see these big differences that we see whenever we look at kind of red and blue on the map of the United States. Trump's job approval rating is above 50%, actually, in 17 states. Most of them not highly populated, mind you. But if you look at the map, that's a big swath of geographic area where Trump's job approval rating is in majority territory. And then there are another 17 states where he's below 40%.
I understand South Carolina is the only coastal state that registers for Donald Trump.
Yes, 50% job approval rating for Trump in his first 6 months in South Carolina. Where he does best, you'll be interested to know, is not so far from where we are, West Virginia. lot of coal miners. In West Virginia, Donald Trump promised he would bring back coal jobs. That's one of his strongholds, at least right now, 60% job approval rating. Other places where Trump does pretty well on a relative basis are the two Dakotas, North and South Dakota, 59-57%, and then Montana and Wyoming, and then down to the South, Alabama, and then Oklahoma, and then Kansas. These are all those traditionally red states where Donald Trump's job approval rating is well into the 50% and higher margin.
Though move up the coast to Massachusetts, and it's a decidedly different story.
Oh, absolutely. If you look in New England, you find the lowest approval rating for Trump of anywhere in the country. Vermont has that distinction of being the state whose residents give Trump the lowest job approval rating of any state we looked at, 26% on average. Then we have Massachusetts, and then we go all the way out to California, a huge state, 30% job approval rating, and then Maryland and New York and Connecticut, all those states on the East Coast, and out to Hawaii, Washington, Illinois.
Let's bring it back to our tri-state region.
Well, Pennsylvania, as we know, is a classic swing state, and their job approval rating for Trump for the 6 months of the year, 43%, slightly actually above the average for the nation as a whole, but New Jersey and Delaware are a little below the mean. Delaware's average job approval rating for Trump in the first 6 months was 38%, and then New Jersey was 36%. So not huge differences across our tri-state area, but clearly more positive vibes for Trump in Pennsylvania than in New Jersey or Delaware.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
This Sunday, the space in front of Independence Hall will become a theater set. A large stage depicting an ancient Iraqi stair-like building called a ziggurat will be erected right in front of the iconic facade. Iraqi national symbols that became familiar to Americans during the Iraqi War will frame a live radio show. The performance, called Radio Silence, connects Iraqi immigrants and refugees who left Iraq with American veterans who fought there. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Lunas has the story.
Radio Silence is a story that starts with Iraq before and after the war, and Radio Baghdad is at its core. When Radio Baghdad signed on in 1936, every morning started with 5 minutes of singing by the local bird, the bulbul. The idea was that nature, not the human voice, should welcome people into the day. Another voice, this time human, came from the city's favorite broadcaster, Barjat Abdul-Wahid, who is often described as the Walter Cronkite of the Iraqi airwaves. Barjat's programs were a combination of news, music, and current events. He was the voice of authority, trusted and respected. But in 2009, Barjat and his wife left war-torn Iraq and settled in northeast Philadelphia, an area where Iraqi immigrants tend to congregate. Once here, multimedia artist Michael Rakowitz, whose family is Iraqi, had the idea of recreating Barjat's old radio program in exile. The project was underway, but then Barjat became gravely ill and died in 2016. Rakowitz had managed to complete only one long day of interviews.
And when he died, you know, the story became more sad, but it became more real and more sort of like horribly poetic because the voice of Iraq loses its voice.
But not for long, says project curator Elizabeth Thomas.
So with Bajat's death, this idea of silence, of our host becoming a ghost, changed the nature of the project, but also the time in developing the project allowed the narratives to shift. And in fact, now there are some people participating who will not use their last names for fears that they have about reprisals in Iraq or their own fears about their citizenship status in the United States. And so the speaking, both in terms of being present and visible and occupying space at the seat of American democracy, have come to mean and represent very different things for people now.
One can be in silence and in a state of remembering. One can be in silence with somebody else and know that they are grieving in silence.
From the start, Rakowicz saw this radio program as a collage of interviews with Barjat, Iraqi immigrants, newscasts in Arabic and English, and audio memories. He also included the voices and experiences of American veterans of the Iraqi War.
I'm Tony Topps, Warrior Writers. I take a deep breath, inhale, exhale, gasping of air, gurgling sounds, long, slow, short and fast breath. Breathe.
The show then, which will be distributed in 10 installments, transformed into a double narrative, featuring cultures forced by war and occupation to intersect.
With these two groups of people that have been to Iraq, the Iraqis who have ended up here as a result of the war, and then of course the veterans who have come back from that place with other experiences, it becomes a way of not necessarily whitewashing Iraq into something where it's just about the happy memories, but to understand that it was a place that was full of dreams and aspirations that were interrupted by a succession of wars that didn't stop from 1980 onward.
All the components of Radio Silence, a mural arts project that's part of the group's Monument Lab initiative, will be in front of Independence Hall. The audience will not only see the live production of an unconventional radio program, but will be surrounded by music, poetry, and food. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Somewhere between summer school and summer camp, you'll find the School District of Philadelphia's Immigrant Children and Youth Summer Program. The annual initiative for recent immigrants and refugees gives newcomers extra exposure to English lessons and a dose of cross-cultural fun. And of course, no summer experience would be complete without a talent show on the final day. WHYY's Avi Wolfen Arendt has took a look at the show.
The kids crowded into a second-floor classroom at Gilbert Spruance School in Northeast Philadelphia came from every corner of the world. Uzbekistan, Syria, the Dominican Republic. But all they wanted to hear was Chester Rodriguez do something distinctly American. They wanted him to beatbox.
You know, kind of the first week is always like kids are kind of like demure and well-behaved, and by like the third week things are like a little bit out of hand.
Elizabeth Weinstein teaches dance and movement at the district's Immigrant Children and Youth Summer Program. Her lessons help them learn English, too.
We incorporated a lot of anatomy. We learned, you know, head, shoulders, knees and toes, hips and ribs.
Knees and toes, hips and ribs and collarbones.
There's no summer program quite like this in Philly. The school district provides the academics, a resettlement agency called HIAS provides the arts instruction, and the final day is a joyous combination of art and accomplishment.
How could you do that? Leave them alone now! I don't want to!
Clavisa Bashali performed a short story she wrote based on a painting of a boy and a girl. Clavisa immigrated to Mayfair from Albania last December.
When I go in school, I was so scared because it's like I didn't know the language.
Clavisa is feeling a little more confident these days. She hopes someday to be a doctor, and perhaps after that, a writer. Avi Wolfman Arendt, WHYY News.
Finally tonight, pedestrians rejoice. Philadelphia's streets will be yours once again. Briefly. The city of Philadelphia is planning to close a 3.5-mile stretch of streets from 3rd and Chestnut to 5th and Indiana in October. The car-free zone called Philly Free Streets will last for about 5 hours. Charlotte Castle, a neighborhood coordinator and architect of the event, says it will connect many neighborhoods.
It's really exciting to have an opportunity to connect the birthplace of our nation to this really diverse commercial corridor up here on North 5th. And from a transportation perspective, we were really excited to bridge the barrier that 676 is between these diverse neighborhoods. So we're creating a safe passageway for people of all ages on foot and bike to cross over what usually disconnects neighborhoods, which is 676.
Last year's Philly Free Streets had more to offer than just open streets. Of the roughly 30,000 participants, were encouraged to join in a number of family-friendly activities and crafts promoting healthy lifestyles. Many of these are expected to return this year, as is the Mural Arts Program, which will be creating some small murals. Mayor Jim Kenney says he got the idea for the car-free zone after observing how people used roads shut to automobiles during the papal visit. Those were closed out of security concerns, but this is for fun. No word yet from the Vatican, but it's pretty safe to say Pope Francis will not be making an appearance. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Banyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our engineers this week are Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Anna Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm John Weber for NewsWorks Tonight.